from PRI, Public Radio International.
My first day of filming was the scene of my arrival at my parents' summer home with my fiancé and his son. Miss Hepburn had not seen me in costume and makeup. She took one look at my high-heeled shoes and disappeared. Returning a few minutes later in a pair of her old platform shoes from the 30s that increased her height by at least 2 inches. That's when I remembered that height was important to her. I suppose that height for her established dominance. She was going to be damned if she'd let me tower over her.
That was Jane Fonda reading from her autobiography, My Life So Far. This is Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, and I'm Isaiah Sheffer, Artistic Director of Symphony Space, the theater on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in New York, where Selected Shorts originates. On this program, we'll hear two stories from an evening at Symphony Space hosted by Jane Fonda, celebrating the women authors of Random House. First, a story by Alice McDermott, a writer who was born in Brooklyn and raised in Long Island. The story is called Enough, and it's about a woman who can't get enough. It's a story about hunger, or more precisely, I like it because it's a story about appetite. This woman wants to have more ice cream, more food, more love, more cuddling. In short, she wants more life. And we were lucky enough to be able to speak to Alice McDermott about her life and her work.
This was a funny way to write a short story for me. Actually, Enough arose out of an assignment I had given to a fiction class myself. In one of my fiction classes, we were discussing the uses and abuses of exposition as opposed to writing scene. And so I asked my students to just to help themselves get a good sense of these two storytelling tools. I asked them to write a paragraph about any character that was simply straight biography, born here, raised here, grew up this way, a paragraph that would just take the character up to a certain point in his or her life. And then I asked them, in a separate paragraph, to simply write a scene of that character sitting down to a meal and see how much of the information that was contained in the exposition would influence the details that they chose as they wrote scene. And when you teach fiction, I think always at the back of your mind is that those who can do, those who can't teach. So whenever I devise an exercise like that I'm not quite sure is going to do anybody any good, I try to fill it myself. And so in using my own assignment, I began to write a story about this character and found myself merging the two paragraphs that I had assigned to the students, both the full biography and that sitting down to a meal. I suppose when I'm in the process of writing fiction, I never see myself as recreating actual people, although once my work is done and the fiction is read, I do hear from people who are quite certain that I've recreated actual beings. But in the process of composition, I'm never concerned with trying to recreate someone or something that actually happened, but rather to create whatever it is the story needs. This story is, I think, as much about celebrating life, what's enjoyable, what's to be cherished. And it is a certain physicality about it, but I think there's also a sense of the daily delight, the ordinary gifts that get us through life. I think this is a character who maybe is never consciously aware of those gifts, but is certainly always grateful for them. I think another thing that I wanted the story to do was to continue the appreciation of sensuousness throughout the character's entire life. I think we often dismiss the joy of life that continues, that sustains itself well on into our old age. And I wanted to make sure that this character had that consistent appreciation for what's delightful and joyous in our daily living. I think what I'm looking for in many of my approaches to character is what would surprise any of us about this particular character. whatever it is that lurks below the surface that we can all observe and all pass judgment on, but those things that those of us outside the inner life of a character might miss, those are the things that I'm interested in recreating or getting at through character. For me, the language itself is the way to get to story. I don't begin with story, as I know many wonderful writers do. That just is not my way of operating. I need the language to find those things in the character that are not immediately apparent. So language for me is not icing on the cake or that extra scoop of ice cream. Language is the door for me. And so I don't feel that I'm working at writing lovely sentences. I feel I'm working at finding the words that will conjure the character and the story for me, and then one would hope for the reader. Enough has been has encountered some controversy since it was published. It was cited as a story that high school students should not read when it was included in an anthology. I think it was in Pennsylvania, which I think is one of the most surprising things that's ever happened to me in my career, that this story of everything I've written should offend anyone. I tend not to write highly plotted stories or novels, but what interests me is then how the same story can become something else entirely when viewed at various distances, right after it happens, years after it's happened, decades after it's happened. It seems to me that's what's dynamic about the stories that we tell ourselves. The events that we describe to ourselves or to others that have happened to us pretty much remain the same. This happened at this hour, and then it was done. So event itself doesn't particularly interest me, but how we interpret event, how we glean meaning from events over time is to me what's most dynamic about the stories we tell about ourselves.
That was Alice McDermott talking about her work. Her story, Enough, was read by the wonderful actress Kathleen Chalfant at one of Selected Short's touring programs, a joint presentation by the Westport Arts Center and the Westport Playhouse in Westport, Connecticut.
Begin then with the ice cream dishes. Carried from the dining room into the narrow kitchen on a Sunday night, the rest of the family still sitting contented around the lace-colored table, her father's cigarette smoke just beginning to drift into the air that was still rich from the smell of the roast and the roasted potatoes, the turnips and carrots and green beans, the biscuits, and the Sunday-only perfume of her mother and sisters. Carried two dishes at a time, because this was the good set. Cabbage roses with gold trim and the white spaces giving off a pale blue shine, that thin, that delicate. Two bowls at a time, silver spoons inside, carried carefully and carefully placed on the drain board beside the soapy water where the dinner plates were already soaking, her mother being a great believer in soaking, whether children or dishes or clothes or souls. Let it soak, the stained blouse, the bruised knee, the sin, brushing aside the priest's brief penances whenever they returned from confession, a lick and a promise, she'd say. It was the way she described their house cleaning technique as well. Sending them into their rooms with a whole rosary to pray, on their knees and a full hour in which to do it. A good soaking. She was the youngest child, the third girl with three brothers, and since the boys were excused and the kitchen too small, their mother said to hold a pair of sisters in it together, this final task, the clearing of the ice cream dishes, was hers alone. Two at a time she gathered the plates while the others sat, contented, limp, stupefied with food, while she herself felt her stomach straining against the now tight waist of her good dress, felt her legs grown heavy from all she had eaten. Sunday dinner was the only meal they had with their father, who worked two jobs to keep them all fed. That was the way it was put by mother and father both, without variance. And the bounty of the spread seemed to be their parents' defiant proof of the man's long week of labor. They all always ate too much at Sunday dinner, and they always had dessert. Pie on the first Sunday of the month, then cake, ice cream, stewed fruits, one Sunday after the other, and always in that same rotation. Ice cream being the pinnacle for her, stewed fruits the depths, from which she would have to rise through pie, if mincemeat, hardly a step in the right direction, if blueberry more encouraging, then cake, always yellow with eggs and dusted with powdered sugar, and then at last again ice cream, store-bought or homemade. It hardly made a difference to her, who was told at least once on every third Sunday of the month that a lady takes a small spoonful, swallows it, and then takes another. She does not load the spoon up and then run the stuff in and out of her mouth, studying each time the shape her lips have made. Look how cross-eyed she gets when she's gazing at it. A lady doesn't want to show her tongue at the dinner table. Carefully, she collected empty bowls and carried them two by two into the narrow kitchen. She placed one on the drain board and then lifted the spoon out of the other and always, with a glance over her shoulder, licked the spoon, front and back, and then raised the delicate bowl to her chin and licked that too. Licked the cabbage roses and the pale spaces in between, long strokes of the tongue from gold-edged rim to gold-edged rim, and then another tour around the middle. Place it down softly and pick up the next. The creamy dregs spotting her nose and her cheeks, vanilla or chocolate, peach or strawberry. Strawberry the best, because her brothers and a sister always left behind any big pieces of the fruit. Heel of her hand to the sticky tip of her nose, lick that too, and then back into the dining room again for the next two bowls. Oh, it was good. What with the stewed fruit on the horizon and all ahead of her, the long wait through fruit and pie and cake. It was, in its finality, in her wistfulness, as good as the whole heaping bowl that had been filled by her father at the head of the table, passed hand to hand by sisters and brothers and set before her. Not that she would have refused a second brimming bowl had it ever been offered to her. Not that she'd refuse a bit of it. Extrapolate, then, from the girlhood ritual, not to say, of course, that it ended with her girlhood, to what came to be known as her trouble with the couch. Trouble on the couch would have been more accurate. She understood later, when she had a sense of humor about these things, that at the time had no humor in them at all. But such precision was the last thing her family would have sought, not in these matters. Her trouble with the couch, it was called. Mother walking into what should have been the empty apartment, except that the boiler at the school had broken and the pastor had sent them all home, and here she was with the boy from upstairs, side by side on the couch. And if you want to mention cabbage roses, well, there were her two cheeks, flushed fever pink, and her mouth a bleary, full-blown rose. And her mother would have her know, once the boy had slipped out the door, that she wasn't born yesterday, and glory be to God, 14 years old was a fine age to be starting this nonsense. And wasn't it a good thing that tomorrow was Saturday and all the confessionals at church would be fully manned? She'd had a good soaking in recriminations all that evening and well into Saturday afternoon when she finished the rosary the priest himself had prescribed, the end point coming only after she returned from the communion rail on Sunday morning and her mother caught and held her eye. A stewed fruit Sunday, no doubt. Her oldest sister found her next, on the couch with her high school sweetheart. Mid-afternoon, once again, their mother, widowed now, off working in an office, and the first four buttons of her dress undone, the lace bodice of her pale pink slip all exposed. And then again, not a month or two later, that same sister found them lounging in the same spot, his head in her lap and his hand brushing itself up and down from her ankle to her knees. a sight similar to one the other sister claimed to have witnessed a year or so later, although the boy this time was different. Then there was that Saturday night during the war when her oldest brother let himself in, too drunk to go home to his new wife on the next block, and found her stretched out on the couch in the embrace of some midshipman who, it was clear despite their quick rearranging of clothes, had his fingers tangled up in her garter. There were buttons undone that time, too. And another, spied by the second sister, who never did marry herself, but who had an eyeful, let me tell you. A Marine this time, his mouth, to put it delicately, where her corsage should have been, and her own hands twisted into his hair as if to hold him there, which led to such a harangue from her remaining siblings about her trouble with the couch that even her old mother was moved to say that there was a war on, after all. Later, her best girlfriend joked that maybe she would want to bring that very couch along with her on her wedding night. And joked again 9 months to the week later when her first son was born that she didn't seem to need that old couch after all. There were 7 children born altogether. The first followed and all the rest preceded by a miscarriage, so that there were 13 pregnancies all in all. Each loss mourned so ferociously that both her husband and her mother advised each time not to try again. Each birth celebrated with a christening party that packed the small house, made smaller by the oversized floral couch and high-backed chairs and elaborate lamps she had chosen, and spilled out into the narrow yard and breezeway where there would be dancing if the weather allowed, a phonograph placed behind the screen in the kitchen window, and the records going all through the long afternoon and on into the evening. You'd see her there after the last guest had gone, the baby on her shoulder and maybe another child on her hip, dancing to something slow and reluctant and melancholy, one for my baby and one more for the road. Lipstick and face powder on the white christening gown that night, as well as the scent of the party itself, cigarette smoke and perfume and the cocktails on her breath. She was a mother, forever rubbing a licked finger to her children's cheeks, scrubbing at the pink traces of her own kisses, forever swelling up again with the next birth. Kids in her lap and her arms wrapped around them even after their limbs had grown longer than her own. The boys, before she knew it, lifting her off her feet when she took them in her arms. She was 46 when she gave birth to the last, and he was 18 and on his first weekend home from college when he recognized for the first time in his life what the sighs and the stirrings that were coming from his parents' bedroom on that Saturday morning actually signified. He did a quick calculation of their ages just to be sure he had it right and then thought, still? Amazed and a little daunted, since he had already begun to think of such sighs and stirrings as something that would pertain to him only through whatever years he spent in a fraternity house. For the rest of the weekend, he imagined ways he might rib them about it, although he couldn't bring himself to come out with anything, knowing full well that even the most good-natured mention of what went on behind their closed bedroom door would get him the back of his father's hand, or worse yet, cause a blush to rise from his own cheeks well before he'd managed to raise any kind of glow on theirs. And wasn't there that Christmas some years after when one of them had given their parents a nostalgic collection of 40s music and listening to Bing Crosby sing in his slow, sleepy way, kiss me once and kiss me twice and kiss me once again. Hadn't their mother said for all assembled to hear, if you don't turn this off, I'm going to have to find a place to be alone with your father. And hadn't he and his siblings, every one of them well-versed by then in matters of love and sex, sat dumbfounded, calculating, no doubt, 71, 72? Still? Shades of the trouble with the couch. She took her husband's hand in his last days and unbuttoned her blouse and didn't seem to care a bit who saw her, doctor or nurse, son or daughter or grandchild or older sister who'd never married herself and couldn't help but say out in the waiting room, "Now, really?" She leaned forward now and again to whisper to him, even after he was well past hearing, her open lips brushing both the surgical tape that secured the respirator in his mouth and the stubby gray beard of his cheek. Growing plump in her widowhood, though she was the first to admit she'd never been what you would call thin, she traveled in busloads of retirees, mostly widows, although there was the occasional man or two, only missing a museum trip or a foliage tour or a luncheon with a cocktail at this or that historic site or country inn if a grandchild was in need of minding. What she could do best, her own daughters marveled at it. Who else would have the patience? Was sit for hours and hours at a time with a colicky baby over her shoulder or a worn-out toddler on her knee and talk or sing. She told nonsense stories, more sound than substance, or sang every tune in her lifetime repertoire from Beatles songs to ancient hymns, hypnotizing the children somehow. Her sons and daughters were sure of it, not always into sleep, sometimes just into a dazed contentedness, tucked under her arm or under her chin, seconds, minutes, then hours ticking by, the bars of summer or winter, late afternoon or early morning sunlight moving across them, across the length of a room, and neither one of them, adult and child, seeming to mark the time gone by, seeming to tire of the routine or the company. But take a look in your freezer after she's gone, the daughters reported to one another and to the better-liked sisters-in-law as well. Nearly a full gallon eaten. Or all but a final spoonful, so she didn't have to put the carton in the trash and give herself away. She's welcome to it, of course, but at her age, it's a weight thing. She needs to watch her weight. It's the deceptiveness, too, don't you see? What does she eat when she's alone? Alone, in an apartment now, since the night a stranger crept up the breezeway and broke the kitchen window and made off with her purse and the portable TV and the boxed silver in the dining room that had been her mother's, she licked chocolate pudding from the back of a spoon. Sherbet, gelato, sorbet, ice cream, of course. She scraped the sides of the carton, ran a finger around the rim. On visits to out-of-state children, she'd get up in the night, stand by the light of the refrigerator, take a few tablespoons from the gallon or a single ice cream bar, but always end up going back for one more and then polishing them off. A daughter-in-law found her one morning, 2 a.m., with the last tiny chocolate vanilla ice cream cup and a wooden spoon, leftovers from the grandchild's birthday party she had made the trip specifically to attend, and gave her such a lecture, as she put it when she got home, that you'd think she'd been shooting heroin. It was the weight that concerned them, said her children, conferring. They were afraid it was the weight that was keeping her these days from those senior trips she used to love, from the winter vacations in Florida she'd once looked forward to. Now that the grandchildren were grown out of the need for a sitter, she should be doing more of these things, not fewer. It was her sweet tooth that was keeping her in so much, alone so much. They solicited a talking to for their mother from her doctor, who instead reminded them all that she was past 80 and healthy enough and free to do or not to do what she liked. They took to stopping by to see her on lunch hours or before going to the grocery store, keeping their car keys in their hands, and urging her to turn off the television, to plan something, to do something. Her grandchildren, driving cars now, asked her out to their kinds of places, treated her to frothy lattes topped with whipped cream that would repeat on her the rest of the afternoon and on into the evening, despite bicarbs and antacids, until she brought herself to tell them when they called, "Thank you, dear, but I'm quite content at home." Peach, strawberry, and reliable vanilla. Rocky road and butter pecan and mint chocolate chip. Looking 90 straight in the eye and still The last thing she feels at the end of each day is that longing to wrap her legs around him, around someone. The pleasure of the taste, of loading up a spoon and finishing it bit by bit, and then taking another and another, one kind of pleasure enhanced by stealth and guilt when it is someone else's carton, someone else's home in the middle of the night, another kind when it's her own, and she carries her bowl in full light to the couch before the television in the living room. Forbidden youthful passion and domestic married love, something like that anyway, if you want to extrapolate. If you want to begin with the ice cream dishes licked clean by a girl who is the old woman past all usefulness, closing her eyes at the first taste. If you want to make a metaphor out of her lifelong cravings, something she is not inclined to do. Pleasure is pleasure. A remnant of strawberries, a young man's hands, a newborn in your arms, or your own child's changing face. Your lips to the familiar stubble of your husband's cheek, your tongue to the last vein of fudge in the empty carton. Pleasure is pleasure. If you have an appetite for it, you'll find there's plenty. Plenty to satisfy you. Lick the back of the spoon. Take another and another. Plenty. Never enough.
That was Kathleen Calfant reading Alice McDermott's story, Enough. After a brief break, we're going to hear a delightful segment from Jane Fonda's autobiography, My Life So Far, read by Jane Fonda. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. We had a remarkable evening at Symphony Space celebrating Random House's women authors, and that was the source of the next reading we'll hear. The evening was hosted by the actor, writer, fitness expert, and dog owner, Jane Fonda. Now, as you know, we almost never have authors read from their own work. Our thing is to have stories read by actors. But when the author of a work is a 2-time Oscar winner for Best Actress, well, we think it's right to make an exception. Jane chose to read a very moving portion of her autobiography, My Life So Far. It's a section that tells about her film acting and filmmaking collaboration with her father, Henry Fonda, on what turned out to be his last film on Golden Pond. The distances and reconciliations between father and daughter in the film script and in real life were so parallel that it made for an extraordinary professional and personal challenge. These difficulties were not made easier by the producer Jane Fonda's need to deal with Henry Fonda's co-star, Katharine Hepburn. The remarkable reading that you'll hear now starts with Jane's first encounter with the feisty legend. And we see once more what a fine actress Jane is, as heard in her perfect vocal depiction of the great Kate. So here now is Jane doing Kate.
I don't like you, said Katharine Hepburn as she pointed her finger straight at my face. Her anger making the famous voice and classic head, which quivered at the best of times, shake with tsunamic tremors. I had never met the legendary actor before, and it was a terrible moment. Coming within minutes of my arrival with Bruce Gilbert, my producing partner, at her townhouse. Terrible not only because someone only a notch below God was damning me, but also because in less than 2 weeks she was supposed to travel to New Hampshire to begin rehearsing on Golden Pond with my father and me. Katharine Hepburn was critical to the financing of this film. No American studio thought anyone would want to see a movie about two old people and a kid. On top of that, my father was suffering from heart disease, serious enough to keep us from getting insurance coverage for the film. Everything depended on all of us working for far less than our usual salaries, and if we lost Katharine Hepburn, the whole project would be doomed. It was difficult for me to know exactly what was at the root of her anger with me. She was famously liberal, so I knew it had nothing to do with my politics. It seemed to have something to do with the fact of my not having been present at her first encounter with my father, my having chosen instead to make a trip through Appalachia with Dolly Parton. Despite their decades in the same profession, knowing many of the same people, Hepburn and Fonda had never met until now. And though my company was producing the film, it had never dawned on me that my presence at this coming together of two Hollywood icons was necessary. For better or worse, need for homage had never reared its head in my 25 years in the business. It never dawned on me that Katharine Hepburn would perceive my absence at the meeting as a lack of respect. But there was another factor at play. The 73-year-old Miss Hepburn had dislocated her rotator cuff and torn a tendon in her shoulder while playing tennis. Our visit was to ascertain whether she would be able to begin filming on schedule. Shortly on the heels of, "I don't like you," came, "I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to do this film, Jane." Announced with the certainty of a New England Brahmin, "I don't think my shoulder is going to get well soon enough, and there are those scenes with the canoe. I'm going to have to carry the wood. So, Jane, you just better go ahead and get Geraldine Page." I soon realized that this whole meeting was, for her, a testing of the waters to determine whether I knew my place, and if not, to put me in it. Once I realized this, I was able to see how vulnerable she felt. She was a legend, yes. But I was the younger actress who, because of youth, was currently more of a box office draw, and only one Oscar behind her. This was important. This was definitely on her mind, as you will see in a moment. She was used to being in charge, but my company was producing the film as a vehicle for my father, and I was in the driver's seat. Moreover, I had not conformed to her need for approbation. Now, with her injury, she probably thought I might want to replace her, and I quickly realized that her opening salvo had been her instinctive way to put me on the defensive. "I don't like you." And by announcing she wasn't going to be in the film, she was assuming the offensive, getting out before I replaced her, scoping out where she stood in the delicate balance of power and protocol. From the moment I sensed what was really going on, it was easy to open my heart to her. I apologized for not being there when she and Dad met and said that under no circumstances would we replace her, that she was critical to the film, which was true, and that we would do whatever was necessary in terms of schedule to ensure that she had time to heal. No sooner was the issue of her being in the movie put to rest than she issued another challenge. "Are you going to do the backflip yourself, Jane?" She looked straight at me, and I think I saw a twinkle in her eye. You see, in the film, the backflip plays an important role in my character's relationship to her father. She hadn't been able to do it as a youngster because, according to him, she was too fat. But this summer, as a grown and newly married woman, she decides to prove to him that she is now able. But holy, I had no intention of doing a backflip myself. There was already a stunt double lined up to do it for me. For one thing, I have a phobia about going over backwards, and for another, I hate cold water. But the moment the question left Miss Hepburn's mouth, the image of her doing that perfect dive in the Philadelphia Story came into my mind, and I knew what my answer would have to be. "Of course I'm going to do the dive myself, Miss Hepburn. I'm going to have to learn how because I've never done one. I'd be damned if I was going to let on that I was scared. The meeting ended with friendly embraces all around. Miss Hepburn announced that 10 days hence, she and her companion and employee, Phyllis Wilburn, would be driving up to Squam Lake to choose a house for themselves, and we arranged to meet them when they arrived. Wanting to check out the housing situation before Miss Hepburn got there, I went to Squam Lake, a wild, pristine body of water, big and irregularly shaped, with small islands scattered about that made it impossible to see from one end to the other. A number of summer rentals had been lined up for me to look at. Over the course of the 3 months we would be there, my daughter Vanessa, son Troy, husband Tom, and our German shepherd Geronimo would be living with me, and plans had been made for my political organization's steering committee, all 10 of them, to come up for some strategy sessions. I needed a large house. My stepmother, Shirley, had already picked out a place for herself and Dad. It was a guest house close to a spacious two-story, eight-bedroom brick main house that sat on a hill with a wide lawn that swooped down to the lake. It was perfect for my considerable needs, and besides, it was right next to Dad. There was another camp close by, much smaller but very cozy, with a beautiful bay window overlooking the water and a number of small outlying rustic cabins. Perfect, I thought, for Miss Hepburn and the ever-attentive Phyllis. At the appointed time, Bruce and I drove to the parking lot of the restaurant where we had arranged to rendezvous with them. Within minutes, their station wagon pulled up. Miss Hepburn got out and came over to me. "Well, have you picked your house yet, Jane?" In that instant, I knew that I was going to have to throw out any assumptions I had about who would take which house. "I've seen a number of houses, Miss Hepburn, but you make your choice first and I'll take what's left." "Now you're talking," she said with a big grin, knowing I'd learned my lesson and wasn't about to make the same mistake again. Whew. It had been a close call. Miss Hepburn and Phyllis in a cozy little cabin? What could I have been thinking? They chose the eight-room mansion. Once rehearsals had begun, Miss Hepburn would invite me over to her house for tea. We'd sit in the comfortable white wicker chairs that were scattered about her glassed-in porch, and she would tell me how I should play my role. I'm serious. And so was she. Miss Hepburn would have me read her part, and she'd read mine and give me line readings. Though I was stunned by this, I never let on that I found it, well, strange. I didn't want to offend her. Though she told me once that she thought the two of us were very much alike, both strong, independent, liberal-minded women, she also let on and let me know what she saw as our differences. For one thing, she thought I should be more involved on a day-to-day basis with the film production, which, of course, is how she was in her heyday, involved in all the details from casting to lighting. She has been quoted as saying, "Acting was all I ever wanted to do." But I wasn't like that. I loved acting, especially once I began producing my own pictures, but it was one important part of my life among others. I had children, my ongoing political work, a new workout business to help fund it all, and a dog. Miss Hepburn was more comfortable with people who had no other attachments, not even pets. She looked askance at all this. She simply didn't understand the concept of having a working partner like Bruce, of having a business unrelated to my profession, and of putting as much or more time into political work as I did into my career. Of course, the whole idea of an actor having children was anathema to her. She told me that she had never wanted children because she thought she was too selfish. "If I had a child and the child got sick and was crying just as I had to leave for the theater, why, if I had to make a choice, the play or the child, well, I'd smother the child to death and go on with the show." You just can't have both. A career and children. I don't think she was right. At least not for me, maybe for her she was. To have had the career she wanted perhaps did require 100% attention. I do know that I felt terrible after these conversations. They played to my tendency to feel that I should be doing my life differently, more like, I don't know, there was always a list of women whose lives seemed more sensible than mine, just like there'd always been a list of actresses who could do my part better than I. I stayed awake many a night, fretting about this, feeling sure that she was right, that my children would grow up totally screwed up because of me. But guess what? They haven't. During our tea time conversations, Miss Hepburn talked a lot about the importance of her parents in her life, always speaking of them as the most wonderful, fascinating parents anyone could have, and crediting them with making her what she was. Apparently, her habit of swimming every morning when she was at her country house in Connecticut, even in winter, was because of her father. She told me that he had insisted all his children take baths in a tub filled with ice every morning before school. When I suggested that this might be considered child abuse, she said, "Oh, no, no, that's what builds character, and that is why I have such a strong constitution and never get sick." I wasn't convinced, but I kept my mouth shut. My first day of filming was the scene of my arrival at my parents' summer home with my fiancé and his son. Miss Hepburn had not seen me in costume and makeup. She took one look at my high-heeled shoes and disappeared. Returning a few minutes later in a pair of her old platform shoes from the 30s that increased her height by at least 2 inches. That's when I remembered that height was important to her. I suppose that height, for her, established dominance. She was going to be damned if she'd let me tower over her. From the moment I arrived in New Hampshire, I began taking backflip lessons from the swimming coach at the University of Maine, who summered near Squam Lake. I started with a belt around my waist hooked up to a rope that assisted me in the flip with a mattress to cushion the fall. After a week or so, I graduated to the coach's diving board, and Troy, my son, would sit poolside and watch his mother's pathetic attempts to get herself all the way around, which generally ended with me landing on my back. I was terrified, always on the verge of tossing in the towel. After 2 weeks of this, I moved to the float, the one in the movie, in front of the house out in Squam Lake. It was the beginning of July, and I had 2 more weeks to get it right. Every day when I wasn't needed on the set, I would be out there, diving backwards over and over again, my body slapping against the water as I failed to make it around. Then one day, I got it right. Nothing to write home about, but I had managed to flip far enough over to have time to straighten my legs and enter the water head first. I wasn't sure I'd ever be able to do it again, but at least I'd done it once. As I crawled, battered and bruised, onto the shore, out of the nearby bushes appeared Miss Hepburn. She must have been hiding there, watching me practice. She walked over to where I was standing. "How do you feel, Jane?" "Terrific," I answered, and it was true. "You've taught me to respect you, Jane. You faced your fear. Everyone should know the feeling of overcoming fear and mastering something. People who aren't taught that become soggy." Thank you, Lord. I'd been redeemed. God knows the last thing in the world I wanted to be was soggy, certainly not in the eyes of Miss Hepburn, a living testament to non-sogginess. It was odd. In the film, the bat flip was to prove myself to my father. In real life, I had proved myself to Miss Hepburn. Dad probably could have cared less if I'd done the dive myself or used a stunt double. There's a scene where Dad and Miss Hepburn are playing Parcheesi, and I'm sitting on the couch reading a magazine. Dad makes a remark about my not wanting to play because I'm afraid to lose, to which I respond, "Well, why do you like playing games? You seem to like beating people. I wonder why." After we shot The Master and the crew had finished lighting for my close-up, I got into place and realized there were so many lights on me that I couldn't see Dad's eyes, which would hinder my playing of this brief, hostile exchange. It was easy to fix. I just asked the cameraman to throw a little light on his face. And that done, it was time for Dad's close-up. And just before we were set to go, I asked, "Is it okay, Dad? Can you see my eyes?" "I don't need to see your eyes," he answered dismissively. "I'm not that kind of actor." Whoa. His words pierced me to my core. It felt like such a put-down. Forget that I had made this project happen for him. Forget my 2 Academy Awards, that I was the mother of 2 children. Forget all of that. I was suddenly reduced to a quivering, insecure fat girl, in the same way my character is. As Chelsea says to her mother in another scene, I act like a big person everywhere else. In California, I'm in charge, yet I get back here with him, I'm just a little fat girl again. I could relate to that. When the scene was over and everyone had prepared to go home for the day, I remained on the couch, unable to move, but sure no one was aware of how Dad's words had hurt me. Then, to my surprise, Miss Hepburn came over and sat down next to me and put her arms around me and whispered in my ear, I know just how you feel, Jane. Spence used to do things like that to me all the time. He'd tell me to go home after I'd done my close-up and say he didn't need me to be around. He could do his lines just fine to the script girl. Please don't feel badly. Your dad has no idea that his words hurt you. He didn't mean to. He's just like Spence. I was deeply grateful for her understanding and compassion. It showed me it hadn't all been my imagination. I had a witness. I wasn't alone. Everyone on the set of the film was sensitive to the fact that my father and I had a complex relationship, and that this film, in many ways, mirrored real life, but with a resolution at the end. I hope that somehow the resolution between father and daughter in the film would lap over to Dad and me in life. He always said that acting gave him a mask that allowed him to reveal emotions he did not feel safe revealing in real life. Maybe showing his emotion about his daughter in the film would release the real ones. There is a scene with the mother when Chelsea comes back from Europe to pick up Billy, her stepson. She is hurt that her father has developed such a close relationship with the boy, and her mother is trying to get her to realize that underneath the gruff exterior, her father loves her, that she just needs to talk to him and pay close attention. I'm afraid of him, says Chelsea. Well, he's afraid of you. The two of you should get along just fine. I don't even know him, says Chelsea plaintively. Chelsea, the mother admonishes, Norman is 80 years old. He has heart palpitations and trouble remembering things. Just exactly when do you expect this friendship to begin? The scene that follows is my key scene in the movie, the one where I confront my father. I wade into the water by the dock as Norman and Billy pull up from their fishing trip. Norman, I want to talk to you. Oh, yeah, what about? He says dismissively. I think maybe you and I should have the kind of relationship we're supposed to have. What kind of relationship is that? Norman snaps. Well, you know, like father and daughter. Worried about the will, are you? Well, I'm leaving everything to you except what I'm taking with me. Chelsea begins to choke up. She fears her attempt at contact will end just like all the others. I don't want anything. It's just, it seems you and I have been mad at each other for so long. I didn't think we were mad. I just didn't think we liked each other. Chelsea is stunned by this cruelty but persists. I want to be your friend. From the very first time I read the script, I would come to that scene and tears would pour down my cheeks. In rehearsals, I was so emotional it was hard to speak the lines. Finally, the day of reckoning came. I woke up and ran to the bathroom to vomit, more scared than I have ever been before a scene, and knowing it was because I had to say intimate words to my father that I had never been able to say in real life. We blocked the scene for the camera and lighting crew, he in the boat, me waist-deep in the water, and even then, I was nearly overcome with emotion. We began with the wide shot that included the two of us, the boat, and the pier. Though I knew a scene like this was ultimately going to play in close-up, I was unable to hold back my emotions. Next, we shot over my shoulder onto Dad, and still, I gave it my all. Then came his close-up. And when the moment came for me to say, I want to be your friend, I did something we hadn't rehearsed. With Dad, everything had to be rehearsed. But I wanted him to have spontaneous emotion at that moment, which meant so much to me on a personal level. So I reached out and touched his arm. What I saw amazed me. For a millisecond, he was caught off guard. He seemed angry even. Then the emotions hit him and tears came to his eyes, and then anger again as he tensed up and ducked his head away. All this was barely visible to the camera, but I saw it. My heart went out to him. I loved him so much just then. Then the camera swung around for my close-up. We did a rehearsal for the camera, and oh no, the actor's ultimate nightmare. I was bone dry, spent, unable to call up any emotions. No one knew it, of course, because we were just rehearsing, but I panicked. What to do? It wasn't that I had to be overtly emotional in the scene, but I needed to feel emotional and then stifle it. I tried to relax, as Strasberg would have wanted. I tried all the sense memories I had, sang my old songs that always made me cry, everything, but nothing worked. As I was pacing around on shore, waiting for the camera to be ready, dreading that the camera would be ready, up came Miss Hepburn. She wasn't even supposed to be on the set that day, but there she was. She looked at me. "How are you?" she asked, sensing something. "I'm in trouble. I've gone dry. Don't tell Dad." And then I was called to the set. The time of reckoning had come. Hoping that some last-minute miracle would unleash my heart, I said to Mark Rydell, the director, "I'm going to turn my back to the camera while I prepare, and when I turn around, it means that I'm ready for you to roll." I turned away to prepare, though I had no idea what to do, and as I was staring at the shore, trying to relax and bring myself into the scene, there was Hepburn, crouching in the bushes, just within my line of vision. Nobody could see her but me. She fixed me intensely with her eyes, and slowly she raised her clenched fists and shook them as if to say, "Do it. Go ahead, Jane. You can do this. You can do this." She was willing me into the scene. Katharine Hepburn to Jane Fonda, mother to daughter, older actress who'd been there and knew to younger actress. It was all those layers of things and more. "Do it. You can do it." With her energy, she literally gave me the scene. Gave it to me with her fists, her eyes, and her generosity. And I will never, ever forget it. On Golden Pond was the largest grossing film of 1981. The studios were wrong. People did want to see this movie about old folks, because it spoke to universal issues with pathos and humor. Never has a movie of mine had such a profound personal impact on people. Never have people, women and men, crossed the street just to hug me and tell me that seeing it and then bringing their fathers to see it had altered their relationships forever. You have no idea how much this has moved me over the years. The film received 11 Academy Award nominations, among them Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actress, and Best Screenplay. Dad was too ill to attend the ceremony, and given his lifelong antipathy for awards and competition, I'm not sure he would have gone even if he had been well enough. But he intended to watch the proceedings with Shirley from his bed. Miss Hepburn did not attend either. It was Sissy Spacek who presented the award for Best Actor. For all his great performances, Dad had been nominated only once before for Tom Joad in The Grapes of Wrath, and this time he had stiff competition: Warren Beatty, Burt Lancaster, Dudley Moore, and Paul Newman. There was nothing I wanted more in life than for him to finally win. When Sissy opened the envelope and announced his name, the theater erupted in applause and cheering. I went up on stage to claim the Oscar on his behalf, as he had asked me to in the event he won. It was the happiest moment of my life. Tom, Troy, Vanessa, and I left the ceremony immediately with my niece Bridget to carry the statue to him. He was sitting in his wheelchair next to the bed when we arrived. Shirley was right next to him, as always. Watching his face closely, I could see he was pleased. When I asked him how he felt, all he said was, "I'm so happy for Kate." The next morning, I called Miss Hepburn to congratulate her. And her first words to me were, "You'll never catch me now." It took a moment for me to understand what she was talking about. And then it hit me, of course. If she hadn't won and I had, we'd be tied with 3 Oscars. Now she had 4 and I had 2. There's no way I'd catch up. I had to laugh. We were still operating on different wavelengths, but how could I not love her spunk? 5 months later, my father died. Thank you.
That, of course, was Jane Fonda reading some scenes from her autobiography, My Life So Far. Jane Fonda hosted the evening at Symphony Space, celebrating the women authors of Random House. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.